You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and this is the Whale Scout Podcast. Today is July 25th, 2014, and welcome to the show. I have taken a small break. I've been so busy with everything going on in the summer up in the San Juan Island. I've been doing fairy talks, volunteering at the lighthouse with Bob Otis, doing some research with some of the whale watching boats up there, and volunteering on Soundwatch. I'm just all over the place, back and forth between Whale Scout headquarters in Bothell and San Juan Island. So it's been great, but I've missed doing the show. But fortunately, we have a gigantic guest on the show today. We have Ken Balcom on, and he's featured in a book called War of the Whales, A True Story. And I recently read it, and I'm super excited to have him on the show. More on that in a bit. But first, I'm going to talk about some of the news. Last week was an event that is called Superpod, and it was the third one, so it's Superpod 3. And it's a bunch of people who've gotten together who are advocating against captivity. So if you've seen the movie Blackfish, all of this, the SeaWorld trainers that have come out and they're speaking against captivity, they're there. Howard Garrett from Orca Network, Ken Balcom was there, and all these people were in the movie Blackfish. And everyone gets together, and over the years they've used these, get-togethers to do interviews for David Kirby's book Death at SeaWorld, do interviews for Blackfish. So it's kind of a cool thing. And now that the movie has really taken off, it's grown a lot, and the public is being invited to attend all these different talks. So it was like literally all week they did a get together at a crab house. I didn't get to go to that because I was volunteering that day. In fact, I only got to go to a few days worth of events, but they went on all week. Some of the things that I went to were a presentation from Rachel Carberry, and she is from she actually lives in Bothell, which is awesome. She has spent two seasons working for Sea Shepherd as a cove guardian, which are these people that document the what happens in Taiji with the dolphin drive fisheries, where they take the dolphins from the ocean and they drive them into coves making loud noises, and they pull some out for captivity, and other ones are slaughtered. And so she talked about her experiences in Taiji, and when she returned home, she was inspired to start a campaign called Empty the Tanks. Some of you have maybe heard of, and they're just a one day sort of demonstration all over the world. And it's called Empty the Tanks. And so she showed a cool little video about that. Other presentations about the history of drive fisheries. On Tuesday, they showed the movie Blackfish at the Grange in Friday Harbor. And afterwards, they had a Q&A from a bunch of people, all the SeaWorld trainers, the old person that worked at Marineland in Victoria, and also Naomi Rose was there, and she gave a presentation the following day. But it was interesting at the Q&A session, she basically said, that we're getting so close with all these captivity issues. It's been up and down for a long time, but she's dedicated her career to ending captivity, and she thinks that we're very close, and that she's just dedicated herself and her career to ending it. And she's hoping that it'll end and she'll just enter retirement and it'll all be great. So, she's a really tough woman, and she is sharp as nails. If you ever have the chance to listen to her speak, you definitely should. I know that she is set up on the agenda for the American Cetacean Society conference that's happening in Newport Beach in November. So look that up, the American Cetacean Society. And of course, there's plenty more speakers that are going to be there. But she was one name that I just sort of starred there, and I'm curious to hear where we are by November. There were other events on the island. The SeaWorld trainers went out whale watching on Western Prince. There was a huge party at the Center for Whale Research at Ken's house and lab, which I was not able to go to, but I saw photos where they were using these drones to take photos. which are sort of a new technique that people are playing with that could be useful for a lot of whale research. And on Saturday, finally, Sandra Pollard's book signing. Her book is Puget Sound Whales for Sale, which you can also buy through the Whale Scout website, along with War of the Whales, which is the book that Ken Balcom is featured in, on the Whale Scout website. And when you do that, a portion of the money gets kicked back to us. So it's one really easy way to help out Whale Scout. And I hope that they're going to do this event next year. You can go to, you know, just Google Voice of the Orcas and look and see, when we get closer to next year, when they're going to do it. And hopefully they do it again. I think they have taken a year off somewhere, so it may not happen. It was sort of loosely organized. Dates and specific locations of certain events weren't, publicized very much. And it's sort of unclear why they did that. Maybe they didn't want too many people trailing around and parking on the street. A lot of the events happened at, just house rentals where they were staying. And it was kind of hard to park all those cars and fill those people in a house. So, thankfully, the Whale Museum opened up their hall, their lecture hall, for some of these talks. So it was great that they did that. And I also should mention Howard Garrett gave a presentation about where we are with Lolita, the one southern resident killer whale that still remains in captivity that was captured from the wild. And they are using a fairly unique strategy with their legal strategy to prove that Lolita should be considered an endangered whale. And they're also using another angle where her facility, her tank, is not up to snuff with the current laws and regulations that govern captive whales. So there's lots of new things happening with this issue of whales in captivity, and it's really exciting. There's another whale. They had a false killer whale that was very, very young, near death, show up in Canada. And now the whale has been transferred to the Vancouver Aquarium, where they are taking care of this whale. And the last I heard is it is now finally eating from a bottle. And this whale probably wasn't even weaned yet. Its teeth were still coming in. So, my personal opinion on this, I don't like to share my personal opinion all that much, but I am concerned about the future of this whale. There are other false killer whales in captivity, and false killer whales really don't frequent the waters off Vancouver. So reuniting this whale back with its pod, which we don't even know who that is, it'd be next to impossible. So by bringing this whale and putting it in a captive situation, it's obviously good because you want to protect that life, but I guess you have to weigh out whether a life in captivity is better than a natural death. So that's the story on that, and I'll try to update everyone with what's going on there. In other news, I've also been reading reports from Alexandra Morton, who works up in Canada, protecting wild salmon, and she's very concerned about the farm salmon industry up there. And it sounds like up near Gold River that there has been a die-off of fish in some of the pens up near Gold River. And so I'm going to put a link on my Facebook page for you all to read about it. But it makes me want to remind everyone how important it is to not buy farm salmon. A lot of the times it seems counterintuitive to buy wild salmon, because obviously you are then also competing for the orca food that's out there, but it's important to support those industries instead of the farming industries, because they're farming the fish not on land but right in the water in the same migratory corridors that wild salmon are using. And so there's things like diseases and parasites and lice and things that can grow on the Atlantic salmon that are farmed, and they can be transferred onto the Pacific salmon that swim literally right through the same exact waters. So I'll put a link on my Facebook page. Just put Whale Scout in on Facebook, and you can read more about that. In upcoming events, I'm going to do a shameless plug here. As I mentioned, I do a lot of ferry talks between Anacortes and Friday Harbor. And this Saturday, I am doing a marathon number of ferry talks. That's on the 26th. Basically, every run that the Elwha is doing between about noon and the last one is leaving from Friday Harbor at 6:30. I'm doing ferry talk. So if you ever want to come see me do a ferry talk or come out and chat, I'll be on the ferry all day Saturday, the 26th, doing ferry talks, talking about whales. Also coming up, the Whale Museum is having a lecture on July 29th. And this lecture is all about minke whales, which would be really cool. So again, it's at the Whale Museum, July 29th. That's a Tuesday at 6:30. So now I'd like to get Ken Balcom on the line here. He, a little background on him. He's been studying killer whales in the Pacific Northwest since like 1976. And he's using a technique that's called photo identification, where he takes a photo of each whale on either side of their dorsal fin and can track each whale over time. And so his job basically is to track the births and death of each family group, and to he provides a census and a ID guide of all the different whales. And over time, we've put together different family trees. And so it's really important work. They're also looking at, you know, their health and body condition. Informally, he also worked in the Bahamas studying beaked whales. And that's sort of where the story starts off, with the book that he is featured in, War of the Whales, A True Story by Joshua Horitz. And so what happened in the book is that he's out, he's studying beaked whales, and then one day all of the beaked whales basically started washing up on shore right in his backyard. And so the story starts from there, and you learn exactly what happened that day. And it follows Ken even witnessing Navy destroyers in the canyon that the beaked whales spend a lot of their time in. And Ken Balcom is also especially interesting because he spent 8 years as a naval officer around the Vietnam War time, and he worked with underwater sound surveillance. And so he has a lot of inside experience and knowledge about, naval acoustical systems, in addition to cetacean anatomy. So it's sort of like this perfect combination, this perfect person to really understand what's going on here. And we're very excited to have him on the show. So let's get him on. We are back on the Whale Scout Podcast with the one and only Ken Balcom from the Center for Whale Research. He is featured in the new book, War of the Whales, A True Story by Joshua Horitz. And today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the book and also about some of the important work that you do in the Pacific Northwest. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure.
So the book is getting great reviews on Amazon. It's Book of the Month for July. It's doing great. It's doing awesome. It provides a detailed look at exactly what happened in the Bahamas in 2000 when the very whales that you were studying began beaching themselves literally in your backyard. And it follows the scientific investigation and the legal battle that followed. And how did you get involved with the author in telling the story? I heard that there were just hours and hours upon for interviews to get the material for the book.
Yeah, well, he interviewed me for about 7 years. He just phoned up one day and said he wanted to do a book on the subject, and we both thought it would be a good idea to have a little more public awareness of what was going on, mm-hmm. what is going on.
Yeah, and in the book, it follows this incident after some Navy sonar was used, but it really does follow your life. And in reading it, I was surprised at just how much of the book was focused on your personal life. Are you the sort of person that's an open book, or do you generally like to keep, more private?
Well, I generally like to keep more private. He just kept asking questions, and he talked to other people about, experiences that we had shared in the past, and sort of put together, a fairly private book. But, he had to build a character, otherwise right. He wouldn't have much of a protagonist.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad that he did it, because, we all get to know you a little bit better. it was fabulous learning more about you. In the book, it goes through exactly what happened after the incident. And it made it sound like you were almost a bit apprehensive at first to point the finger at the Navy for causing the strandings, even though you saw a lot of the destroyers and you have experience with the Navy and a lot of their procedures. Can you describe exactly how your experience in the Navy shaped the way that you handled the stranding incident?
Well, I spent 8 years in the Navy, basically in sonar operations for 5 years, but it was passive sonar. We weren't sending out any signals. We were just listening for submarines. And I knew the Navy to be an honorable profession. They're, you know, good folks. And I didn't really have that much hesitation about bringing the issue up with the brass. I just thought I had to bring it up at a high enough level that it wouldn't get ignored. And I was also concerned that there would even be a fair investigation in the U.S. system. But we considered for a while trying Europe or Great Britain as being the place where we'd take the specimens and have them analyzed. But actually the Navy paid for us to bring them to the States, so we did.
Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of legal wins and losses in the book as, you know, lawyers worked to protect the cetaceans in the world's oceans. You know, one victory was that the Navy actually took responsibility for the stranding incident in the Bahamas. However, ultimately, the courts decided that national security sort of trumps the health of marine mammals. In your opinion, you know, is there space in the ocean for both marine mammals to live, you know, safe lives away from sonar, and also enough space for the Navy to train so their men and women are prepared?
Well, there certainly is enough space in the ocean for the training and for the survival of the whales. The Navy has to, you know, they're basically oriented toward their military operational requirements and the logistics of how far away the training area is and how much fuel it takes and how many days and weeks of training are required. Whereas I'm concerned that the areas in which they train are relatively unoccupied by animals that would be adversely impacted. So, we can point out, you know, sanctuaries and habitats that are well occupied by these animals and encourage the training to be held elsewhere. And we know of areas where there are very few of these animals. So that is, for us, a logical place to actually conduct such training.
Would some of these areas be like further offshore and maybe they're concerned about fuel consumption?
Well, in the case of the Northwest Training Complex off the Olympic Peninsula, I've advocated that the training be the bombing and the explosive training be further offshore, mm-hmm. primarily to protect our southern resident killer whales that are designated endangered that use the coastal waters. So it doesn't involve an additional 40, 50 miles offshore for the most intrusive kinds of exercises. Unfortunately, some of the need of the Navy are training in the littoral zone or the coastal shoreline area. So we have to find areas that are suitably sparse in the cetacean fauna or the marine mammal fauna, or any of the species that are impacted by these activities, and designate those as training areas and training seasons. Some of them are just seasonally occupied by the animals. But basically, it requires more knowledge of the animals on the part of the operational Navy.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that they haven't already moved to those areas and in practice in those times of the year? Or is there a lot of resistance there?
Well, there is resistance. It's sort of damn the whales full speed ahead kind of thing. You know, military minds are pretty focused on the military mission, and this sort of environmental mission or anything that is perceived to dilute the training is not as well accepted as the needs of the operational training.
Mm-hmm. And you brought up, you know, the Northwest Training Complex, and
right.
and you know, I wanted to ask you about the whale L-112, or her other name is Sook, who stranded in Long Beach in 2012, and she had very unusual injuries, you know, bruising on the one side of her body, and yet no broken bones. The final report came out that, you know, they couldn't find any cause of death other than blunt force trauma, and there was no real cause. And if I understand correctly, you went and you have said that they should reopen the case. Can you talk a little bit about that and explain why you think they need to look at this again?
Well, okay. I actually saw that whale shortly after she was born. I saw her in February, 2010. Off Victoria, and I called her Victoria, but others call her Sook, whatever. But she was a very vivacious little animal. I really enjoyed following her life and hoped to watch her grow up. And she would be a reproductive addition to the population, being female. We need more females in that southern resident killer whale population. Anyway, there was a Canadian military exercise held in February 2012 that involved a couple of warships starting outside the Strait of Juan de Fuca using active sonar, pinging and dropping explosives at intervals all the way in past Nia Bay and the entrance to the Strait of Juan de Fuca on the U.S. side of the border. Down to about the level of Dungeness, and then they moved over to the Canadian side of the border and dropped some more explosives, and all the while pinging their sonar. And we noticed immediately afterwards that, we noticed during the exercise that there were southern resident killer whale calls on hydrophones at Folger Deep out off Banfield, and that southern resident killer whales went in and were in the bay, actually, the first time we've ever heard them in the Nia Bay area on that hydrophone system right inside the bay. And then in the morning, there were killer whales in Discovery Bay, an unusual assortment of Ks and Ls. So the whole thing was shaping up like these whales were basically driven in by the sonar. It's just like a drive fishery in Japan or the Faroe Islands, where you make a lot of noise and you can move the animals in the direction away from the noise. Anyway, so there were explosives on during this exercise. So my question was, here's a reasonable, parsimonious explanation for a whale that dies of unexplained blunt force trauma. One side of its brain essentially liquefied by some sort of intense pressure field without any broken bones. It's characteristic of a blast type injury. And the only contravening factor was that she stranded far down the Washington coast at Long Beach near the Columbia River. And I pointed out to the investigators after they did their draft final report, it's still just a draft, it's not a final document by all means, that one of the things they should have considered was the intense and unique caregiving behavior that is well known in this, in killer whales in particular, but also other small cetaceans, where they will carry their dead and injured offspring, sometimes for days and very long distances, much like elephants that mourn their dead babies and carry the carcass around for a while, until they finish doing their ceremonial goodbyes. So it's entirely reasonable. We know that the L-pod whales then appeared down off the Columbia River in the Oregon coast. It's entirely reasonable that that's what they had done. And that is not unparsimonious. It's much simpler to take explosions that you know did happen as a probable cause rather than invent the hypothetical explosions elsewhere that caused the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I just asked them to reopen it because clearly the Canadian Navy had misled and actually lied in the investigation, and it was a legal enforcement investigation, which requires truth be sought, and the enforcement people should have questioned it further. In fact, I've heard now that they have correspondence between the Canadian Navy and the U.S. Navy at high levels that probably have a little more detail to what the Canadian Navy actually did, but they did it on the U.S. side of the border, which if I were to go out and throw hand grenades in the water, would be illegal without some sort of permission authorized.
Right. And have you witnessed for yourself, the Southern residents or other whales, carrying a calf or another small whale? And how many days do you think could they carry another whale for?
Well, I have not personally witnessed it, but there are well-documented accounts of killer whales, for example, supporting an injured young killer whale for up to 2 weeks. There are many reported instances in the scientific literature of dolphins and pilot whales carrying their dead infants for days and tens, if not hundreds, of miles.
Wow.
It's been well documented. This is a reasonable, normal behavior response to an injured offspring, particularly, or even just a relative, or even just another of your species.
And what is the hope for the book that just came out, War of the Whales, A True Story? Do you hope that it will garner people's attention and motivate them to put an end to this? And will there be an end to Navy sonar harming whales? Like, what's it going to take?
Well, there won't be an end to Navy sonar harming whales. They don't mean to, I'm sure, even in the cases we've described in the Bahamas and with L-112. It's that there isn't enough information used in the training planning to even attempt to mitigate the effects on the animals. And for crying out loud, it's already designated a critical habitat. This is not one in which you would have a war game. The occupancy of these whales in that habitat at that time can be verified by listening, by just listening to the... I mean, you can dial it up on the web right now as the hydrophones that are at Barkley Canyon off the Canadian coast, San Juan Island. In fact, we heard the explosions and the sonar on the San Juan hydrophones and the whales. So it isn't like you don't have any way of knowing whether or not whales are in the area of potential impact. If you don't know that and you're looking to practice finding enemies, you're not up to speed.
And can you tell people, what they can do to help support you and your research? There's membership, I've heard, with the center that they can get involved with. Let people know, what they can do to help.
Well, we do have a membership, and you can sign up and receive benefits like keeping track of our southern resident killer whale population and ID guides and so on. That's a very useful thing to do for naturalists and people that are really deeply interested in these icon animals. But what you do about the sonar kinds of impacts and the explosion and the training impacts on marine mammals is when you have opportunity to comment on the proposals that are put forth by the Navy. For example, we just had a extensive series of public input opportunities for the Northwest Training Area Complex. And I don't know how many people actually read what's going on or understand what's going on, but essentially it's asking permission to conduct war games in a critical habitat. I mean, if they sought permission to conduct war games in downtown Seattle or Tacoma, then you'd probably have some public input, but people don't know that the areas that they're proposing to conduct these trainings are essential to the survival of the animals.
And I always ask, you know, people that come on my show, I ask them, you know, one, what I call the final question, and about southern resident killer whales. And I ask, you know, what is the one thing that anyone can do to help recover southern resident killer whales? And what is your one thing?
My one thing is feed them. They eat salmon. They eat Chinook salmon. We know very well that 80% of their diet is Chinook salmon, large, nutritious salmon that we also like to eat. But what we have to do is ensure that there is sufficient food supply for the whales. If we have to forego a few fish, forego harvest, take down dams and increase the abundance of these fish, then that's what we have to do if we want to see this population survive. And at present, it's showing all indications of not surviving. It's decreasing.
Mm-hmm. So that's your one.
Can't have a pet if you don't feed it. That's the first thing I learned when I had a little puppy. You got to take care of it. You got to feed it.
Exactly. And so yeah, your recommendation would be the dams. Is that your number one thing for salmon recovery? Because I know there's so many things you can do for salmon recovery as well.
Well, the dams are one of the factors that has affected salmon abundance and caused, you know, we've got basically throughout the Northwest or throughout the range of the Chinook salmon in the Pacific coast, we've impacted habitats, built dams, blocked their access to their spawning and reproduction areas. We've harvested them. We've polluted them. You know, they definitely need help. They've been decimated, truly at levels one-tenth of what they historically were. And we have to find ways to reverse this. Some of it's dam removal. Some of it's habitat restoration. Some of it's closer monitoring and licensing of the harvest. And some of it's just agricultural practices or even consumer practices. I hate to bring up another issue, but if you go to the store and buy salmon, you know, you should be very critical about where that salmon came from. Farms, for example, are producing salmon that are not, they're affecting the recovery of wild population. They're not to be, I don't eat them. I wouldn't recommend. I mean, you're destroying the economy of proper management of wild salmon, and you're also creating a competitive environment that you're raising these farm fish right where natural fish go through and they get diseases and parasites and genetic pollution.
Right. And that's like one really great thing that literally anyone can do no matter where you're from. You know, making a difference with your dollar and buying wild salmon as opposed to farmed or Atlantic salmon. And I want to also direct people to your website, whaleresearch.com. And I encourage everyone to become a member and help support the good research that you guys do. You get lots of cool things like the ID guides and email updates. And so I encourage you all to go up and do that. And thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, you're very good. You run a good show.
Thank you so much. And hope to have you on again sometime. So thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Bye.